Okay, Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com back with you here on the Mike Malloy Show. Mike is out sick. So I'm here today and tomorrow. He'll be back with you in fine fettle on Monday. You don't hear that much anymore, do you? Fine fettle. Please stop by if you like over at BradBlog.com. We've got an open thread going on there. Love to have your thoughts concerning Governor Don Siegelman or anything else that's on your mind. He's going to be joining us here momentarily. Our phone numbers are not Mike Malloy's normal phone number since we're broadcasting from lovely Los Angeles at AM K-Talk AM 1150. Our numbers are now 877-520-1150. If you'd like to get into the show and have your voice heard over the break, I was told someone called in and said I sound like a right-winger. Okay, then. Really? Do I? Please stop by bradblog.com and give me your feelings on that. If you think I'm a right-winger, man, I don't know what you're paying attention to. Apparently, you ain't reading bradblog.com. Coming up shortly, as I said, Don Siegelman's going to be with us. John Bonifaz from Voter Action is going to be with us at the bottom of the hour. Next hour, A.K. Muckraker from Alaska talking about everyone's famous, soon-to-be former governor, celebrity community organizer, Sarah Palin, yeah. So we're going to be talking about that and whatever else is on your mind. First, though, going to go to Governor Don Siegelman, who has been, a frequent guest on the Mike Malloy program. We're glad he's back now to talk about some of this extraordinary, frankly, extraordinary new evidence in his case. He has now filed a motion for a new trial, which, for my money, given the way the prosecutors carried out this case under the under the Bush-Cheney Department of Justice, should I call that the Bush-Rove Department of Justice? Should I call that the Karl Rove Department of Justice? The way the misconduct, the prosecutorial misconduct that went on, that has now been revealed in this new evidence, the testimony that their star witness spoke against Governor Siegelman was cajoled and threatened by the prosecutors is absolutely remarkable. Governor Siegelman joins us from Alabama now. Former Governor Siegelman joins us. Welcome back to the Mike Malloy Show, Governor.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be back. I thought for the sake of those listeners who may not be familiar with the story, let me just give a minute synopsis. I was prosecuted for something that the New York Times has said has never been considered a crime in America. That is, I appointed a contributor. It wasn't even a contributor to my campaign, but it was a contributor to a statewide referendum that I was promoting to establish free college education for Alabama high school kids. And I reappointed him to a board on which he had served through three previous governors. The Republican State Attorney General in Arizona on CBS's 60 Minutes said that there were so many red flags in this case that he could only conclude that the Republicans could not beat me fair and square, so they targeted me with this prosecution. Time Magazine ran a piece a little over a year ago where they described how I was selectively prosecuted. Mm-hmm. But I was targeted by Karl Rove's client in Alabama just days after I became the first Democratic governor to endorse Al Gore when he was running for president. And I was brought to trial 1 month before the Democratic primary when I was running for re-election by Karl Rove's best friend, a best friend's wife, who was the U.S. attorney.
Just to fill that out, Karl Rove's best friend was the husband to the U.S. attorney who was in the process of prosecuting you, correct?
He not only was the husband of the U.S. attorney who was prosecuting me,
right?
This is Karl Rove's best friend, but he was also running my Republican opponent's campaign against me.
The campaign manager for Bob Riley, who's running against you.
Right, so my prosecutor's husband, Karl Rove's best friend, was running my opponent's campaign. Now, let me explain why Karl Rove gets into Alabama. People say, wait a minute, who cares about Alabama? You know, well, after the 92 Bush Quayle campaign, the husband of my prosecutor, who had been a special assistant to Bush One, who had worked with Andrew Card, he was the chief of staff to the NRC. He ran the ground troops working with Karl Rove for the 1992 Bush Quayle campaign. After they lost, both of them, Karl Rove and the husband of my prosecutor, came to Alabama. They both married their, found their wives in Alabama. Karl Rove married a girl from Mobile. He settled on the Gulf Coast in a place called Rosemary Beach, where he has his home today. Karl Rove and the husband of my prosecutor worked a bunch of campaigns out of Alabama, in Alabama, trying to take over the Alabama Supreme Court, as well as running a campaign for the state attorney general and other races. But I started doing battle with Rove back in 1994 when he was trying to steal his first election in the state of Alabama. And but anyway, that's how Karl Rove came to know me, and,
right.
and I guess came to decide that I was somebody that needed to be dealt with, because I kept winning elections in the face of his efforts to defeat me. And
you did, and it was, I guess you were the governor just one term, in 1999 through 2003. And in that 2002 election, I've always been impressed, Governor, because you've been able to, you've just come out and said it. You went to bed in 2002, you thought you were the winner, and then you woke up in the morning, and what, a Republican district, they found, what was it, 13,000 extra votes?
Well, I went to bed as the winner. I had won the election the day of the election. I had won. In the wee hours of the morning after the lights in the courthouse in the South Alabama Republican county had gone off, the votes were recapitulated in the in the basement in the sheriff's office, and they took 5,000 votes from my column, electronically shifted them over to my opponent's column. The interesting thing here, Brad, is that by taking 5,000 votes from the Democratic column for me and moving it to the Republican column for Bob Riley, it did not change a single down ballot race. Not one other vote was changed. So how they managed to do that and get away with it is beyond me. But
only your election had the numbers that needed to be corrected on that. And I think it was a Diebold tabulator, wasn't it, that you guys use out there, a Diebold system in Alabama?
I believe that's correct. And
yeah.
the two people who took credit for that were, one was Karl Rove's partner, a woman named Kitty McCullough, who later changed her name to Kelly Kimbrough. But anyway, that's another story. And also a guy who went to work for Jack Abramoff immediately thereafter. Interestingly, John McCain, in his report to Congress about where Jack Abramoff was spending all these millions of dollars of Indian casino money, came up with emails from Jack Abramoff and to Jack Abramoff from Ralph Reed, who was the Christian Coalition fame. So they documented that $13 million from Jack Abramoff, who is I refer to as Karl Rove's bagman. They documented that $13 million came into Alabama to defeat me in 1998 in my first election, to defeat the education lottery proposal, which was the genesis of my legal situation now,
right.
and also to defeat me in 2002. And again, Abramoff money comes in 2002. The guy that claims he stole the votes goes to work for Abramoff immediately after the election. It's all very curious.
It's curious is a nice way to put it, and we haven't even gotten to the prosecution now and what it is they pulled in 2006 and the information that has now come out. I'm going to have to ask you to hold, if you don't mind, during the break. I want to get to that new information. And frankly, as I've said, you know, Eric Holder has dropped that Ted Stevens case up in Alaska, a Republican case, and a couple of other Republican officials up there. That case, frankly, your case and what we're now seeing makes the prosecutorial misconduct up in Alaska look like jaywalking as far as I'm concerned. Not only should your case be thrown out, but the prosecutors, the attorneys, many of whom are still in the job, frankly, charges need to be brought against them. We're going to go into some of those specifics with Governor Don Siegelman from Alabama right after this break. I'm Brad Friedman in for Malloy. Governor, thanks for hanging in there. We're going to talk to you right after this. Stick with us. Mike Malloy program, Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com in for Malloy. We're speaking with Governor Don Siegelman of Alabama, who is facing what I think is one of the most outrageous political prosecutions I have ever seen. He's currently out of jail on appeal, has now motioned for a new trial in this so-called, frankly, so-called bribery case. And we saw the new evidence coming out this week. I wrote about it at bradblog.com because I was just blown away by the way the federal prosecutors were revealed to have manipulated the star witness of this case, the one who claims, who makes the claim about this check that was given from Richard Scrushy over to the governor for use in the educational lottery fund, a campaign that he was working on in Alabama to improve education. And as the saying goes, the governor put this Scrushy fella on the hospital on a hospital oversight board out there in Alabama. In return for the payment, problem is, Scrushy had been on the same board under three former administrations. And when you take a look at this evidence, and Governor Siegelman, I'm going to let you talk a little bit about the evidence, but let me read this piece from the transcript. Because not only does it appear that they manipulated the witness, they also, the feds, didn't turn over the material that they should have from these 70 or so meetings with this star witness. Okay, in the trial, the judge asked the prosecutor, he said, first of all, I need to confirm whether the government has had the opportunity to confer with all of the investigative agencies, law enforcement officials who were involved in the investigation of each of the defendants in this case, and has discovered that there has not been exculpatory material that would be available to the defendants. Now, the acting U.S. attorney, Lewis Franklin, says in reply, Your Honor, we did. We checked with all the agents. They have no other reports that have been turned over in this matter. The agents even contacted the IRS agents who participated early on in this investigation and who were not participating in some of the instances where Mr. Bailey, this key witness, Nick Bailey, was interviewed. They have no additional reports. This is what the prosecutor said in court. Okay. He goes on to say the AG's office has also confirmed by going through its file that there are no additional reports regarding Mr. Bailey, the key, the star witness for the government. Governor Siegelman, from these new declarations that have been filed in your case, it appears that Mr. Franklin is out and out not telling the truth, that there was, what, some 60 or 70 meetings that Bailey had with the prosecutor and only a handful of them were turned over to your defense team?
Yeah, I think there were maybe 8 or 9 documents that were turned over by the government, but as it turns out, there were some 70 interviews with this witness, and of course he had disclosed on CBS's 60 Minutes in February of 2008 that he had been interviewed over 70 times. And that he had been made to keep his answers, write his answers in a notebook, a three-ring notebook, because the government got so frustrated with him because he would not say what they wanted him to say, so they made him write it down until he got it right.
They wrote down, they said, we're going to write down our questions, and we want you to write down the answers. And then, by the way, this notebook where they wrote down the questions, where he wrote down his answers, that was not turned over to your defense team. And as it turns out, some folks who have now, your attorneys who have now looked at this, actually Scrushy's team, I think, his investigators have looked at it, and they said there was answers written down that Nick Bailey says, this isn't my handwriting, and his attorney says, this isn't my handwriting either. They were writing these answers, telling them what to say, Governor.
Apparently, they were coaching him on the legal language that they needed him to repeat in order to complete their circle, their conspiracy circle, and their circle for the jury. But there were documents that had been withheld that we could have used to cross examine the witness. There were documents that they withheld that we believe are exculpatory. In other words, would have shown that I was not guilty. We have a number of witnesses that are willing to testify that Nick Bailey told them that he was coached. He was led to say things that he now believes he can't even believe that he actually said those things in court.
Because he was facing jail time himself. He was hoping, they said they kept basically walking him to the gallows for his sentencing and then pulling him back, and he was trying to get a short sentence if he could.
Yeah, well, this process went on for about 5 years. And during that period, they threatened him with a 40-year prison sentence. They threatened his brother with going to prison. And you know, finally, this guy, it's sort of like waterboarding. You know, after you've been waterboarded 70 times, you know, you finally just say, just tell me what it is you want me to say, and I'll say it.
Governor, I got to get out. 10 seconds. What can people do to help you here real quick?
One, say a prayer. Two, say a prayer for Eric Holder that he changes out these Republican prosecutors, and let's get some fair-minded people in that we can deal with.
Thank you, brother. We will talk more about this after the break, but I got to let you go. Thank you, Governor, and good
Thank
luck
you
to
so
you.
Thank you so much, Brad.
You
All right,
bet. Bye-bye. All right, Brad in from Malloy. Back after this.
Reform every state, every city. Election reform, like Iraq or Ukraine. Election reform in the USA. We don't believe
that's it. Singing Shannon. It's our buddy Shannon Williford from down in Nashville. We're going to talk about election reform with John Bonifaz, legal director of Voter Action. Shortly, I'm going to try to get in a couple of calls. Some folks who called in during the Don Siegelman interview that we didn't get to, so hang on there. I'll get to those quickly, and then over to Bonifaz. Brad Friedman in for Malloy. Introducing the all-new Chevy Equinox with an EPA estimated 32 miles per gallon highway. Well, that's good. And up to 600 highway miles on a tank. Well, that's good, too. It's the most fuel-efficient crossover on the highway. Go to Chevy.com/Equinox. Based on GM compact crossover segments, excludes other GM vehicles. All right, let me get real quick to Stephen, since he's out here in Burbank, after all. Stephen, a quick thought on the Siegelman interview, Siegelman case there.
Okay, Brad. Well, ask any political science professor or historian, and they will tell you one of the most favorite tactics of an unjust power structure is to eliminate the political opposition. And if you get a guy in there who's going to bring college education to the, quote, unwashed masses, unquote, that is a threat to the power structure. And I also have a little sidebar about you being accused of being a right-wing caller.
Yes.
Well, a talker. Well, I talked to a right-wing guy who is one of either liberal handed your other guy's favorite guys, and I got him to listen to KTLK. I asked him about it later. I asked him, what'd you think? He said, oh, I heard right-wing stuff. And I said, well, what did you hear? And they, well, they were blasting Democrats. They were picking on Democrats and blasting them, you know. And now that gives you an insight as to how they think.
That's right. Well, of course, because those guys, hey, if you're a Republican, no criticism, no nothing. God forbid a progressive should beat up on a Democrat. They don't get it. They really don't get it. And you know what? If they listen to progressive radio more often, if they could find it, if they listen to K-Talk, they would find out that progressivism does not equal Democrat. Progressivism does not even equal liberal. There's a lot of very conservative ideals in progressivism. Oh, like the rule of law, follow the Constitution, don't let these guys like Karl Rove get away with the crap they, you know, that they did by twisting and bending the laws and using the Department of Justice as a political bludgeon, as they did in not just Don Siegelman's case, but in case after case. They prosecuted Democrats at a rate of 5-1. That is illegal, period. And we need to restore justice at justice. And let me use that to plug my organization, velvetrevolution.us. We've got a campaign, restorejusticeatjustice.com. Please go on over there, make your voice heard, sign on to that campaign, and, you know, call for the not just the Siegelman case to be vacated, but Eric Holder needs to look at all of the prosecutions during the Bush era and toss out those that were political prosecutions. Stephen, any more thoughts for you?
Well, what it is like we just have to keep pushing, and don't give too much credence to Eric Holder, because we have to remember this is a deep, dark thought, and I hope it's not true. He is subject to the unjust power structure, and that is corporate, top of one-tenth, you know, multinational cartel. So I don't know what to do except keep pushing it. I don't know what
keep
to
pushing,
do.
Keep pushing. Keep making noise out there, Stephen. Really appreciate it, and especially pushing those wing nuts to listen to some of the truth over here on Progressive Radio. Much appreciated, Stephen. Let me get to John in Scottsdale. John, welcome to the Mike Malloy Show.
You stole my thunder, Brad. You did a beautiful job with that idea. My concern is Siegelman's absolutely right, but he spent time pointing out that Roe was had relations in Alabama. But if you look at this thing that Roe has put in place, it's national, and you find cases like that in Mississippi, New York, California, Georgia, in a variety of places where the Department of Justice is being used as a political, and get this, a financial weapon against the opposing party. And the finance people overlook. I mean, millions of dollars can be spent on one of these court cases. And I wanted to add one more thing to your spiel, is that they use it against Republicans. If a Republican isn't in line with what, say, in the Bush administration, with that particular policy, he's subject, you know, Stevens. One of the best Republicans that you ever have as far as voting party line, bang, he must have stepped out of line, and he's got a multi-million dollar suit. So
and
you're doing a great job, and you did steal my thunder, damn you.
Sorry about that, John.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Well, that's what us right-wingers do, you know that.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate the call, John. Thanks a bunch. What's going on in this Justice Department? People, you have to make noise. You have to participate. You have to, you know, call your legislator, demand that they restore justice to justice on all of these cases like Siegelman's. And there were, we don't know how many there were. That's why at restorejustice@justice.com, we are calling on Holder to investigate how many of these prosecutions were actually political. RestoreJustice@justice.com. This has got to stop, and we're going to talk about more about it tomorrow night. Glenn Greenwald is going to join us for tomorrow night's show, as is Greg Pallast. I believe he called me during one of the breaks here. He's going to be with us tomorrow night because, you know, Greenwald is ticked, and I'm right there with him because, you know, Holder, we've got news today that he, Eric Holder, quote, has told associates he's weighing a narrow investigation for torture, focusing only on CIA interrogators and contract employees who clearly crossed the line and violated the Bush administration's guidelines. Their guidelines were illegal, people. What does it take to get this message across to you? Across to you, Mr. Holder. Across to you, Mr. Obama. Okay. We're going to switch gears. We'll come back to that in the last hour, and we'll open the phones. We're going to talk about Sarah Palin, but we'll open the phones to any damn thing you want to talk about. But I want to get to John Bonifaz, because all of this comes down to elections. And if you can't count on the elections, if you don't know, if you can't throw the bums out, and I don't care which side of the aisle the bums are on, if you can't throw them out, then it doesn't mean a whole hell of a lot. And we've got a serious problem with our election system. As you heard, Governor Siegelman talked about it. He had paper ballots, by the way, back in 2002. It wasn't the ballots they messed with. It was the tabulators. And they, according to Governor Siegelman, they switched the votes in the middle of the night on the tabulators. And then they never let anyone see the paper ballots. Secret software, secret counting. That's trouble. We're trying to do something about it. I'm joined tonight by my friend, John Bonifaz, the legal director of Voter Action. That's voteraction.org. Prior to joining Voter Action, John worked for more than a dozen years with the National Voting Rights Institute, an organization that he founded in 1994. And he was on Capitol Hill, I believe, today, trying to get them moving in D.C. on election reform. He and I agree on most things. We've got a few disagreements about the latest legislation, but we'll get there in a bit. John Bonifaz, welcome to the Mike Malloy Show.
Thank you, Brad. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for staying up late out there. I know it's been a long day. Were you actually testifying, or were they in committee today out there in D.C.? What's going on with election reform? Everybody thinks, oh, problem solved, nothing to worry about now, but that ain't the case, is it?
Well, we were, no, it's definitely not the case. We were releasing a report that we have authored jointly with Advancement Project and the NAACP National Voter Fund, and we were presenting it before the House Administration Committee at a hearing it held today, dealing with these issues. The report is based on data from two major voter hotlines, the CNN and My Vote One voter hotlines, in 2008, and it highlights that despite the decisive outcome that occurred at the presidential level, this was not a trouble-free election. Anyone who thinks that somehow we've moved beyond the problems of 2000-2004, it does not have the right facts. The facts, unfortunately, are that we have a long way to go to protect our vote and protect our democracy.
We do indeed. And these calls were stunning. And I believe that these were calls, to the, as you said, to the caller hotlines that came in on Election Day and I guess earlier during the election, the early election period. I'd like to play, you put together a montage a couple of minutes here of some of the calls.
Yeah.
Let me play those to give an idea. Just a sampling of, you've got hundreds and hundreds of these, is that correct?
Tens of thousands, actually. Nearly 70,000 people on Election Day called reporting the problems they were facing at the polls.
And these are, give you just an idea of some of those problems that were being faced all over the country.
Presently at Velda City polling place in St. Louis, Missouri, in North County, voters who've been waiting since 10 this morning have not been able to vote. There is inadequate equipment. It is very, very poorly organized. And as a result of that, many voters have left.
My issue and complaint is in the Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Ward 59, Division 4. Only one of two machines working this morning at 7 a.m. when the polls opened, although there were already more than 200 people standing in line.
My name is Robert. I'm calling from Pensacola, Florida. I've been in the Army for several years, and I now live in Pensacola. And in order to vote here, I have to have a Florida ID. So I went to get a Florida ID, and all of a sudden, on the 1st of October, they've changed the rules. Well, I have to have a birth certificate, which means I have to go back to my state and get a birth certificate, come back to Florida to get an ID just to vote. And there won't be enough time to do that between now and when the votes actually take place.
I'm a student in the University of Miami, and I just finished voting in voting precinct 561. People were turned away. People were leaving lines. There was three lines attempting to funnel through the door. They were unable to locate my name, even though I presented my voter registration card and my ID. It is the biggest disaster that I've ever seen.
I had trouble at the voting booth this morning. I put the access card in. It beeped. It did not advance. And I pushed it in a little further again, and then it said I voted. And I did not. I never saw the screen advance. And I approached the woman, the voting person there, and they said, well, sorry, you already voted. Well, I don't know who I voted for, so that was my problem.
I'm calling from Chesapeake, Virginia, in the Crestwood area. We are having problems at that location, Crestwood Middle School. We have thousands of people in line. They only have 6 voting machines, and they're all down.
I'm in Douglasville, Pennsylvania. The problem I'm having at our polling station was we were voting, and I don't know if there was something wrong with the polling machine, but the polling machine was voting double or triple for whatever candidate you chose.
On Saturday, my husband and I tried to vote in Orange County, Florida, and were told that we were purged from the system. When I renewed our driver licenses at the Division of Motor Vehicle, we were asked if we wanted to also change our voter registration address. We agreed to do that. However, we were told by a supervisor of elections at the poll that 90% of the changes made at the DMV are never passed on to the supervisor of elections.
John Bonifaz, unbelievable. Those calls are not, there's a lot more of them. They're representative of thousands of calls, right? These weren't unusual to the calls that you guys received at the voter hotline on Election Day last November.
No, they're unfortunately not unusual. They were part of really the pattern that we saw in so many places in the country where people were facing these kinds of barriers in accessing the ballot and having their votes be properly counted. And I think the story that's coming out of this report today, and to hear these voices again from the voters themselves, is that we have to be vigilant in continuing the fight to protect the right to vote and the integrity of our elections. I should say that we've uploaded 900-plus calls from these various states that we're focusing on via this report: Florida, Missouri, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Georgia, and Virginia. And these calls really do give the broad sense of the array of problems that voters faced on Election Day and our call for reform to protect the 2010 election.
And we're going to talk about your call for reform after this break. Speaking with John Bonifaz of VoterAction.org on their new report. Brad Friedman in for Malloy. John, stick around a little bit. We're going to talk to you about reform and if we have a chance of seeing that ever happen. Brad in for Malloy. Stick with us.
Jojo lived his home in Tucson, Arizona, Boston, California grass. This is my democracy. You won't go telling me my vote don't matter anymore. Our vote is well worth fighting for.
Yeah, it is. Brad Friedman in for Mike Malloy, speaking with John Bonifaz of VoterAction.org. VoterAction.org. There you go. On his new report today, these troubling phone calls that came in on Election Day to the voter hotlines out there, and they're not unusual. The trouble is, John Bonifaz, I was looking at the database, Barack Obama's database, the DNC database, in the days leading up to the election. Their error database or their own hotline. Problem after problem exactly like this. And as far as I could tell, the Democrats and Barack Obama, unfortunately, were not doing much about it. Your thoughts, John?
Well, I don't know whether I would agree that they were not doing much about it. They had their own independent operation, obviously, that was a partisan operation. We were not connected to it in any way because we're a strictly nonpartisan organization. We were monitoring the data.
But there was touchscreen machines that were flipping votes all over the country, and they weren't pulling them out of service. And when Republicans see that happen to them, that's what they do. They sequester those machines. They get them the hell out of service. The Democrats don't seem to be taking this seriously, and I'm not trying to get you to beat up on Democrats here. I'm saying this by way of saying that Democrats are now in control. Rush Holt, congressman from New Jersey, has a bill that I know you support. It will require paper ballots eventually, 2014, it'll require paper ballots finally for everybody. But A, can they get it passed? And B, is it enough? And C, do you have the same concerns I do about the secret software still in that bill?
So let me address those questions, but let me just come back to the issue of what happens during an election cycle, because I think they are separate and distinct questions. The issue of whether partisan operations can be counted on to engage in those kinds of things like taking machines out of commission or fighting on every single possible front to protect the right to vote is precisely why we need a nonpartisan, vibrant nonpartisan voting rights community, because there are strategic political decisions that are made that are not necessarily about whether the right to vote gets fought for during an election or during a campaign. So that's just my point on that there may have been some other strategic political decisions that may or may not have been the right decisions, but are not always with the lens of how do we engage in small d democracy. And that is why we need to kind of have this monitoring that we've discussed via this report that was done during the election. Now, as for the Holt bill, yes, we are very strongly endorsing this bill, and there's language in this report calling for voter-marked paper ballots that is why we need this bill. Had we had a choice in terms of where it should go, we certainly would say that everything should be overhauled by 2010. To be clear, the paper ballot requirement is there for paperless jurisdictions by 2010, and then for 2014 for jurisdictions that have the printers attached to DREs, which are useless.
Exactly. Continues the fiction that those touchscreens, if they have a paper trail, that they're
exactly.
somehow better.
We agree on that.
Okay.
As for where the bill's going, it's our view that it needs to be pushed by the grassroots community in order for it to go anywhere, and it already has a broad array of endorsers. We did not get behind the prior bill, as you know, Brad, because it did not ban electronic voting. This bill does, and in our view, that's a significant advancement. As for the secret software question, were we litigating in Sarasota, fighting to get access to the machines, to get access to the underlying source code and the source materials, with this particular bill as law?
John, I got to get to a hard break. I want to be fair, though. Can you stick around just for a minute at the top of the hour? Okay. John Bonifaz, back with more right after this.